Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Dervil MacDonald with you this morning. Well, our newspaper panellists have been busy selecting the best and the rest from today's papers, and I'll introduce them to you shortly. But first, let's have a look at what is making the headlines today. Ministers dash hopes of cuts to income tax. That's the lead for the Sunday Times. Philip Ryan reports that there will be little to no income tax in next year's budget, as the government has instead decided to dramatically increase spending on housing and to reduce the VAT rate for the hospitality industry back to 9%. And that is quite the turnaround for the sector after all of the kerfuffle over the VAT rate for hotels and restaurants in this year's budget. For the Business Post, it is fiscal incontinence slammed as spending doubles in decade, the paper splashing on a rather colourful phrase supplied to them by the economist John Fitzgerald. The Post's lead says that major vulnerabilities in the public finances loom as state spending is on track to have doubled in just a decade. The Sunday Independent and the Irish Sun on Sunday both lead with the release from Garda questioning of a man arrested in connection with the suspected murder of missing American student Annie McCarrick, who disappeared in 1993. And that story is covered extensively across all of today's papers. The Irish Mail on Sunday continues its investigation into hospital consultant payments. Meanwhile, the Irish Sunday Mirror leads with an interview with Jules Thomas. This is the former partner of the late Ian Bailey, who has revealed, the Welsh artist has revealed to the paper that she is battling an incurable illness. The Sunday World reports on the pending release from prison of a convicted rapist and killer. David Lawler, who killed civil servant Marilyn Rinn 30 years ago, was the first killer in Irish history to be caught as a result of DNA testing, and that's a report by Patrick O'Connell. The Middle East crisis is also widely covered in today's papers and dominates a lot of the news coverage in the UK as Prime Minister Keir Starmer sends more fighter jets to the region, with Tehran threatening to strike UK and US bases. New battle lines is the lead for the Observer, which has a really, really striking image on its front page this morning. We'll be coming to all of the main stories, including the intensifying situation on the Middle East shortly. But first of all, I should probably introduce our panel to you. With me this morning are Ellen Coyne, political correspondent for the Irish Times, Ciara Murphy, senior policy officer at the ASRI, Dr. Graeme Finlay, assistant professor of politics and international relations at UCD, and Cormac Lucy, economics columnist with the Sunday Times Ireland. And you're all very, very welcome. But first of all, before we get to all of the stories, let's first of all go to Washington, D.C., where yesterday's massive military parade was overshadowed, first of all, by huge anti-Trump protests, and then by the assassination of a top Democrat politician in Minnesota, as well as her husband. And authorities say the shooter, who remains at large, had a target list including other Democrat politicians and abortion advocates. Niall Stanage is a White House columnist at The Hill. Niall, thank you for joining us. I know it's 6 a.m. there, so no thank problems. You for joining sure. us early this morning. But can you tell us what is the latest on the hunt for the attacker?
Well, the short version is they don't have him yet. This is obviously a very tragic and at times slightly bizarre instance where this man appears, the suspect appears to have been dressed as a law enforcement official of some kind. He first showed up at one politician's family's house. That politician and his wife were shot but have survived. He then appears to have gone to this the house of another person, a former state House Speaker, Melissa Hortman, and her husband, and they were killed. As far as the suspect is concerned, they do have this a suspect, 57-year-old Vance Bolter. The motive is not crystal clear yet, and as I speak to you now, he has not been apprehended.
Yeah, and it was just such extraordinary. I suppose all of the mood had been expected to focus on the big parade in DC. What is the mood there this morning? I saw that you tweeted yesterday the W.B. Yeats poem, The Second Coming. You know, things fall apart. The centre cannot hold. What's it like there this morning?
I would say in general the atmosphere in the US right now is pretty bleak. Obviously, this killing has really put a sharp point on the fears around political rhetoric and political violence. It is an enormously polarized country at the moment. You know, sometimes people will ask, what do the American people think of X, Y, or Z? And it's really very hard to talk about the American people now because they are very much divided into two political tribes who often see things through a completely different lens. So all of that is rather bleak, as I say, and this assassination, frankly, is part of that picture.
As well as the assassinations, there were lots of protests yesterday, the so-called No King's Day of Defiance. Obviously, they were cancelled in Minneapolis because of the shootings. But otherwise, did they draw big crowds? I think they were saying that there was, you know, 200,000 different sites from, you know, tiny villages to big cities.
Yes, they did. These No Kings protests were held in about 2,000 different locations across the US, according to organizers. The organizers, citing figures from the authorities, figure that there were several million people across the country in all. The 200,000 figure, I think, was New York, 100,000 in Philadelphia, so on and so forth. And these protests, as the name suggests, were really galvanized around the idea that Donald Trump is engaged in an excessive power grab. A lot of it was based upon the idea that he is an authoritarian, or at least authoritarian-leaning figure. And of course, the whole reason that the protests were held yesterday was because of this separate military parade here in D.C., officially to celebrate the 250th birthday of the U.S. Army, but coinciding strangely enough, with Donald Trump's birthday.
With his 79th birthday, did they pass off peacefully, finally, Niall Sandage? You know, there, obviously there had been huge concerns about potential clashes, not least with the deployment of the National Guard to L.A.
There was some trouble in LA, although I'm cautious about ascribing that to the No Kings movement. Overall, it was very peaceful nationwide. In Los Angeles, there were some scuffles between law enforcement and protesters.
There we go. We'll let you go back to bed or go for a coffee, whatever it is, Niall Sandage, at 6 a.m. Thank you so much for joining us. And we will be returning to U.S. matters and more later in the show. But for now, let's turn to the story that has been dominating headlines here at home. It is, of course, housing, and there is so much material. Ciara Murphy, you picked out a piece by Killian Woods, From Not Perfect to Not Viable. This is in the Business Post.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of really interesting coverage, and I think the Business Post kind of did three pages and, you know, conversations with the developers. I think actually probably my favourite piece was by Ian Guider, also in the Business Post. And it really points out how this is kind of, you know, it's fiddling around the edges and it's not coming to terms with the real problems that developers face: zoning, planning, financing and infrastructure and services. And, you know, and he points out just some really good, like bad planning decisions, like, you know, Ambor Planola saying that this massive development in Cork was visually obstructive. And the one in Terranure that residents had objected because it would lead to falling house prices, which is kind of the entire point of us improving housing supply. So, I mean, just these decisions that developers at that point have already put in so much money, and the uncertainty around what the planning decisions
are
going to
be. So if something gets knocked back, you then have to go back to the drawing board in terms of planning it. There is something interesting in it about it, though, you know that we do object, and we don't want. There are areas that do not want their house prices to fall. So we're all part of that.
Let me clarify. Some people object. I'm a 30-year-old renter. So the problem when people object, and I've had very heated arguments with family members who've objected, I can't object to those people objecting, right? We have no voice. The people who don't own homes have no voice. The next generation have no voice. And I think Cormac's piece in the Business Supplement about intergenerational inequality.
In the Sunday Times.
About intergenerational inequality and about how socially destabilising that is such an issue.
Cormac Leese, there's a point you raised in your piece today in the Sunday Times, which is, you know, just for all of the brouhaha about mortgage rates, you know, there's a significant part of the population who are, you know, who are doing quite well in terms of maybe their overall wealth, in terms of how that's ascribed to home ownership. And so there are tensions between those who, you know, talk about meaningfully changing the housing crisis, but don't want their situation to change?
Well, I'd say it's more than a significant part. The current government would not have been re-elected if close to half of the electorate wasn't in an I'm all right, Jack type of scenario.
So is that a demographic thing then?
It's a demographic thing. So older people are benefiting from the current setup because as more people immigrate to Ireland, as too few houses are built, there's increased upward price pressure on houses which they own. There's increased price pressure put on renters which they don't own and must pay. And there's a whole range of benefits that older people are getting that younger people aren't getting. The pension age, in my opinion, I'm 64, is way too low. You know, I think it's crazy that we've got the fittest cohort of older people ever, but a lot of them, now I wouldn't intend retiring, I want to keep going. It's also healthily better for you to keep going. But the central point is, there's just this colossal institutional complacency at the heart of the government response to what is becoming an ever worsening emergency. And their response is to have somebody like Dara O'Brien as minister, succeeded by James Brown as minister, instead of giving the housing ministry to the most heavyweight players in the cabinet. They're giving them to lightweights.
But then what are the solutions? You know, when Ciara's just saying there, you know, when the core problems for, you know, developers have been identified, and the central bank as well, you know, kind of warning this week that we need investment in housing for the infrastructure, for the water, for all of that stuff. So are we into compulsory purchase orders? Are we into mandatory, you know, banking and zoning of land? Like what is going to get us out of that mire?
I think we need a legal response. If it were me, at the heart of government, I would be declaring a national emergency on housing. We need to identify a person or a group of people. So Charlie Haughey in 1979 appointed Albert Reynolds to become Minister for Posts and Telegraphs, as it then was, to fix the expletive-deleted phone system, as Haughey told Reynolds when he was being assigned this. Reynolds didn't even know when he got the job whether he was being made a junior minister or a senior minister, so exasperated with Haughey's mandate. Yeah. And then we need to address planning. We have got an absolutely broken planning system with a whole bunch of people who seem to think that their role in life is to be bed blockers. And I do not understand.
Well, that's a tricky term, bed blockers, but essentially people are opposing.
It's not the people opposing, it's the people running the system on behalf of the state. They seem to think that that having a long checklist of qualities that each new property must have is more important than getting on with building properties. So in 2006-07, we were able to build 90,000 properties a year. We're going to have difficulties hitting 30,000.
Ciara, we know the answer to that question. We got the biggest experts in the country to write a massive report and to look into this for years, the Housing Commission report that was published last year and has largely been ignored. And I mean, one of the things that this rent reform really doesn't get to is it keeps trying to incentivize private investment without really focusing on the fact that the public investment is key. Getting 20% ownership, they have been very clear, that is a priority. 20% social and cost rental housing. And that's not just about throwing money at it, because they're just throwing money at it without getting that financing to cycle around, without getting it to pay for itself. So there's huge reforms there, systemic reforms, radical reforms, and this is just twiddling around the edges.
Ellen Coyle, you picked a piece in the Sunday Independent, renters are the victims.
Yeah, so this is an opinion piece by Owner Brin, and I think what I found to be the most interesting part probably touches on something that Ciara and Cormac were talking about there. So in terms of how the political reality of these rent reforms announced by the government this week will play out, I think Brenda Power was pointing out that the majority of people in their mid-20s to their late 40s who are renting, that would include Ciara, are actually aspiring homeowners. The point of the rent reforms, even though it was wrapped in political language that made it sound as though it was about protecting renters, is about enticing investors. And for that to work the way the government intends, rent has to go up. So the most significant part of the announcement is that landlords will be able to reset rent to market rates after March 1st, 2026, when the tenancies expire. So if a renter who's in a state of transience, in a state of churn, as Owner Brin is pointing out, an average tenancy is only 3.5 years, those new tenancies will be set at the market rate, which means it could obliterate somebody's chance, if it hasn't been obliterated already, to save for a house. And what I'm interested in is if this policy works the way that the government intends, if it incites more people to invest in build-to-rent properties, are you going to have a situation where there's actually more competition for first-time buyers from people who now decide that actually if they have the capital, becoming a landlord is more attractive to them? So rents are going to go up. That is the intention of the government policy. And I just wonder how that plays out. And to touch on what Cormac said about the people who were like, I'm grand, I have a house, I've nearly paid off my mortgage. Like Brenda Powers' piece is talking about how she's now watching her adult children and has the sense dawning on her that rather than them having their first home by 2030, they might have a better chance of renting by 2030.
And Graham, it's interesting, you know, that Cormac was talking about kind of, you know, older homeowners, but there was a piece talking about actually the concern about the older demographics in the rental market. And presumably that's going to be an even bigger problem as people now in their 40s and 50s who didn't get onto the property ladder are also, as they get older, going to be facing some of those vulnerabilities.
And there are some very stark figures in the article in the Sindo about the real specifics of how these changes are going to hit individual people. It's really good that there's that level of detail in the papers because people are really worried that they're life, which is difficult enough as it is, it will become unsustainable. I mean, some of the figures you're talking about, older people who, if their rent goes, the rent they can find is all but 30 euro of their income for the week. And that income is not going to change, right? So that is very, very worrisome. And again, the way we treat our older people as well in this state who aren't in that favorable situation of owning their house is very, very concerning. I think more broadly, all of these little tweaks founder on a couple problems. One is enforcement. It's very, very difficult to enforce the rent pressure zones as they are. You know, since 2019, there have been 200 sanctions against landlords for exceeding the rent caps. I mean, that's minuscule.
I think the amount of money they recovered was it 70 grand or something?
And it works, exactly, yeah. And it works both ways. You know, landlords who are not getting any rent from their tenants also have to go to the district court to get that money, to get the tenants out. Obviously, that's very costly, takes a long time to do. Now, the RTB does provide legal assistance, but it's not totally clear how easy it is to avail of that. So just at the coalface, at the point of conflict where people's lives are on the line, it's not working.
So do you think that, you know, and there was a report, I think, that the Residential Tenants Board, it was Gabby Gadavkaicha and Gwyn O'Connor in the Sunday Independent saying the Residential Tenants Board will get extra powers to keep landlords in check. Do you have faith or confidence in that in circumstances where landlords, if they see what's coming down the tracks, you'll be able to get an economic eviction if you need to. You know, you can say the property is needed for X or Y.
It does look from the way these have been described in a really badly communicated way that landlords will actually probably be able to do more in terms of removing tenants for all sorts of, again, very often justifiable reasons. One of them is economic hardship, which is very hard to prove but are very hard to disprove as well. But, you know, I think it's just, it doesn't do much to address everyone's day-to-day. I mean, looking through the article, they say new powers in the headline, but it just looks like new resources in the actual body of the article.
Resources are critical to whatever enforcement powers you have.
The other part I think is really problematic is the way all of these supports for new buyers are all directed at new builds, you know, which is a recipe for a sprawl. And in West Dublin, there are apartment buildings going up all over the place. You just stumble upon them on a weekly basis, which is great. And hopefully people are getting used to the idea of living in apartments because that's what's being built. But, you know, there's so much we could do in existing communities to revitalize them, to get rid of voids, to maybe CPO or at least put pressure on owners of derelict and vacant properties to get people to live over the shop. You know, all these places where there really isn't land to build and yet people want to live.
Can I ask you, Cormac Lucy, Killingwood's his piece where he's looking at from not perfect to viable, but he notes that institutional investment into the Irish residential property market has fallen by 80% over the past 2 years. But we're not alone because it's fallen by 88.2% in Germany, 73.5% in Sweden, 62.1% in France, and lesser, I think 11.9% in the Netherlands. So what's happening more broadly, lest we think that this is just investors not wanting to come into Ireland because of our bottlenecks?
I think internationally, investment in property is losing attractiveness relative to other destinations
because of the yields.
Potential investment. Rent returns coupled with potential capital gains. Mm. But those other countries you mentioned, none of them have seen their population grow by 40% over the last 25 years as we have. So we have by far and away the biggest population growth of a significant European country. And yet we have a constipated property development. You know, my reaction to this rent
incontinence
control.
Incontinence and too many images for Sunday morning.
but the key solution to rent levels is greater supply of new properties for people to rent and exert downward pressure on rents. There was a comment in one of the articles in the Sunday Post from a developer making a presentation to the state saying not a single new apartment block began construction in the last 12 months.
Can I also counteract this idea that supply is going to bring down rents? We are in what, like a 300,000 deficit at this point. And at the moment, in a high migration scenario, the headship and with headship rates, so that basically means how many people want to live in one house, we're getting worse every year. So for supply to actually work to bring down rents, and that means like especially private supply, so this it's going to take a generation. And this is why the focus of the Housing Commission is on social and cost rental, because the only way to really get rents down is for the state to be able to provide lower rents.
Yeah, but that also then raises that investment question. There was an interesting piece, Ciara, I think you picked out. It was actually an investor or developer who was talking, and he sort of anticipates that a lot of people might push back on what he has said, but he does speak to some of the challenges that he perceives in terms of even domestic builders, the challenges that they face.
Yeah, so it's Rick Larkin, who also has a podcast on this issue. And he basically says they've stopped residential investment in Ireland. And I think they're a family business that's been running for 40 years. And they talk a lot about regulations. And this is one of the big issues in Ireland. And it's one that the Housing Commission pointed out as well, that basically we regulate as if we have oversupply. So really high regulations and constantly changing regulations. So it's really hard to keep up with them, and it makes apartments incredibly expensive to build. So the Housing Commission basically recommended a regulatory impact assessment for every new regulation that they want to bring in to say, what will this do to supply? What will it do to cost? And I think, you know, more broadly, doing that for all the regulations, saying, okay, which of these regulations is actually worth it? Which one, you know, basically, so they're talking about this now. I think there was news that this is going to come out. But really saying, and then saying, these aren't going to change. We're not going to change these 9 times a year as they have been doing.
Ellen Coyne, can I just ask you about the politics of this? Eddie Byrne, who's the CEO of one of our largest residential landlord, IRES REIT, he said, the current draft, while not perfect, is a step in the right direction. I didn't believe the government could give more protections to tenants whilst also making conditions for investment even slightly better. This somehow achieves that. Do you think kind of being caught between that rock and the hard place of having to protect tenants, encourage investors, did we achieve any clarity, or at a political level, is it just more confusion?
Well, I mean, if you read the Sunday papers today, you get the sense that not just government TDs, but even some government ministers were struggling to kind of grasp this and communicate it to people because it was so incoherent. And I think the reason that it was so difficult to understand what the government was telling us this week is because it was saying two contradictory things at the same time, which is, number one, we're trying to increase investment, and number two, we're trying to protect renters. Any normal renter, any normal voter sees those as being like incompatible things. But I suppose to bring this back to earlier on this year, you know, Micheál Martin went into a parliamentary party meeting and warned colleagues that they were going to have to make unpopular decisions. And I think if you have decided that what you want to do as the government, and we can debate, you know, the rights and wrongs of it, is to bring forward a measure that increases investment, then just tell the public that that's what you're doing and sit with the fact that it will be desperately unpopular with some people, instead of trying to say, well, if you were with a small landlord and if it's after the first, like people were flabbergasted, people were totally bamboozled and couldn't understand the policy. But I think if you want to have the courage of doing unpopular political things, tell the public what the unpopular political thing that you're doing is in very plain language, because I think it was unfortunately and unnecessarily damaging to James Brown, who has been briefed against already during the lifetime of this government, to have a policy that was difficult to explain and difficult to sell, because I'm not sure the government had the courage of its conviction to actually tell the public in plain language what it wants to do.
There's another issue on that, and that is if Micheál Martin and the government had a politically short-term, unpopular plan to fix the housing crisis, the time to roll it out
would
was
be
in
not
the first 3 months of the government.
Yeah.
They haven't done that. That suggests they don't have such a plan.
And if even if this works, the government itself conceded that it's going to be years. Now, I mean, talking about, oh, you know, they won't be in power anymore kind of becomes a moot point with how long we've had Fine Gael in power and how long we've had Fianna Fáil in power. But I suppose they will be conscious of that, that even best case scenario, if loads of investors were like, this is the best idea ever, the actual gains from that, the increase in supply that the government is banking on would happen after the next general election as well.
Graham, what's your sense of the realpolitik of the situation?
I mean, it is striking that these are being rolled out, these very investor-friendly and landlord-friendly measures are being rolled out by a government which does not have a centre-left voice in it for the first time in a while, you know. And so, but again, whether they're expecting to get kudos for this policy would be a bit surprising. To make a change without being able to give the reasons in a coherent way to each and every everybody's different situation is really a recipe for a political disaster, because you're not going to satisfy anybody.
No, at any one time. I just want to move on more broadly just to the economy. Ciara, that lead in the Business Post, fiscal incontinence slammed as spending doubles in a decade. Given what Cormac has said about the, you know, rapidly aging population, the fact that we have had population growth, is the amount of public spending in the last decade so outlandish, or?
I don't think so. And I think this is a lot of the problem with this narrative, is there's this real focus on public spending without the other side of it, which is taxes. So this is why I thought it was so funny that that was the front page of the Business Post, and the front page of the Sunday Times, I think, was basically like, oh, the hopes have been dashed of income tax cuts. You can increase public spending. And they're comparing this to 2015, where we're coming out of a massive period of austerity, and when absolutely we needed to increase our public spending again. We hadn't built houses, we hadn't built any infrastructure, we hadn't fixed a road. I mean, it was desperate what would happen. So we needed to increase our public spending. The question is, how do you finance it? And the point there is tax increases, right? So you cannot increase your public spending. We're relying on very vulnerable tax increases. There's this story that came out that the 2008 crash and our fiscal problems were because of increased public spending. It wasn't because of increased public spending. It was because we hollowed out our tax base during a boom. We cut taxes massively during a boom, and then we were left with almost no tax income, you know, this massive drop in tax income during the crash. Yeah. We're doing the same thing again. Increase public spending. Tax me more, but give me services, please.
Ellen Coyne, what's interesting, though, even before the last election, you know, when every time the public was polled about whether they wanted, you know, more income tax cuts, they were like, yes, please. Like, you know, so we could be quite contradictory in terms of this demand for services, the demand for the infrastructure, but at the same time, you know.
Yeah, and I thought as well, like that Sunday Times front page that Ciara was talking about, there was a really interesting nugget buried in it, which kind of implied, based on the briefing to Philip Ryan, that any spending that will be in the upcoming budget will be on housing, which goes back to the last conversation that we were having. But so much of like what we've said on the panel this morning is about how action wasn't taken on housing soon enough. The other thing that I think is bubbling up, and I've heard it from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael TDs, that it's coming up so much at their parliamentary party meetings as an issue that's equal with housing, is the issue of disability. So I was really curious reading Philip Splash about how if the priority is on spending on housing in this budget, even though Micheál Martin and Simon Harris have set a very different tone on disabilities, which requires massive amounts of investment for resources and staffing, are you kind of building effectively your next housing crisis by not focusing spending on an area that I think a lot of the public, even if they're not directly affected by it, have a family member or friend, and that's an area that the public would actually like to see investment in? Like the two biggest kickings that the government got last year, or government figures, was the Kanturk issue in the general election, the failed referendums on care. So I actually think there's an untapped political issue there, which if I was trying to focus or limit my spending, that's where I'd be putting it in this budget.
If Cormac Lucy, spending is a concern, Mandy Johnson was writing in the Business Post today, Ireland is badly in need of a doge with a razor sharp scalpel to cut state waste. Do we not already have one?
Well, we do in the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, but I agree with Mandy Johnson. I think her piece is insightful. What we really need is we need the political will to apply the findings that we might get. I would disagree somewhat with Ciara on the overall spending level question. In the last 25 years, our tax revenues have multiplied more than five times. That's way at the top of the European League. The German tax revenues have only doubled. Look at Britain. Look at France, look at Germany. They all have really severe budgetary constraints that are really impacting on day-to-day politics there the whole time.
And if we didn't have those surpluses, we also would as well.
Correct. We are so reliant on tax revenues in the multinational sector. And in my opinion, we cannot rely on them. We have to view a significant element of those tax revenues as windfall in nature. Now, I do agree with Keir. They could be invested usefully in infrastructure.
But what's interesting, Mandy Johnson is saying, look, it's in badly need of a doge. Not necessarily an Elon Musk, but that kind of notion that someone would come in and, you know, cut that waste and systematically go through that. So is it a question then of political will and leadership? Is that not just whole of government approach to it rather than...
Well, I think it's easy for people on the right and centre-right of politics to imagine that there's this colossal amount of waste in government, and if only we find a clever person who can go in and find it, we'll all be better off. In my opinion, there isn't much waste in government. There is a lot of money going on things that maybe it shouldn't be going on, but behind cutting those things lies a never-ending series of hard political choices that your backbenchers are going to hate.
And I think one issue where this is, it's really clear that there's not much waste, but what there is there's a lot of throwing money into black holes because we're not willing to actually approve spending on long-term capital. So things like giving lots of money to asylum seeker hotels instead of building state structures. And that's very difficult to get through that exact department, the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform, because it's the idea of trying to keep a lid on expenditure without understanding that if you keep a lid on one expenditure, your other one is going to absolutely balloon with nothing to show for it at the end, and with really poor like social consequences, integration consequences, political consequences too. So I think there's a really big conversation to be had around how we think about controlling public spending when we know that there is a huge demand. And the same, I think, is true in health.
Yeah. But Graham Findlay, that is very much then about communicating. That's a bigger narrative that you have to try and articulate.
I mean, it is a very big cultural change to move from one-off payments, which again, you know, in everybody's individual lives, you know, are extend to sort of communion dresses and stuff like that. Important things, but having one-off payment for things like first communions and this and that. And I think it's really important to remember that for most people who are, you know, on the average industrial wage or below, their whole life is a confection of little bitty payments and various schemes and maybe multiple forms of work, which they have to constantly manage. It's exhausting. As opposed to me, I get a check every month or a deposit every month, you know, don't have to worry about those things. You know, it's exhausting, I think. And it's not a replacement for investment, but to move from these little one-off payments, again, in the area of housing, like the HAP, you know, it's very important for people to know who are in receipt of HAP that you have a right to have that HAP, and landlords, it's against the law to deny you accommodation on the basis of being a HAP.
But in
user.
Reality, many turn away from
enforcement again. But you know, to move from that culture to the idea of investment that the state is going to do it is a big change, but one which is long overdue.
Yeah, a big step change. But listen, we are just going to take a quick break. We'll be back with you in a few minutes.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back with me this morning. Ellen Coyne, Ciara Murphy, Dr. Graham Findlay and Cormac Lucy. Ellen, I just want to go back to you. Obviously a lot of coverage on the riots and protests in Ballymena and further afield, both in domestic as well as international papers this morning. You were really taken by Jason Johnson's piece. I think it was in the Sunday Times.
Yeah, that's right. Particularly there is an interview that he has done with Amanda Brown, who is a survivor of child sexual abuse at the hands of her stepfather, Davy Tweed, and she just kind of nails what has been happening in Ballymena with a quote saying, "Where was the anger when I was abused?" She's pointing out that when her abuser died, there were so many tributes paid. There were the Orange Order members at his funeral. There was condolences from the DUP, from the TUV. And she's basically saying that the message that's being sent to survivors of sexual violence in Ballymena and any of the other communities that have been affected by violence over the past week, it seems that your worth as a victim depends on who your abuser is, where they're from, or what side of town ground they're on. And I think that that is really important, because I personally was a little bit uncomfortable with some of the narrative this week of being like, oh, violence, like that's kind of typical of the North, particularly from people down here who are kind of creating a bit of distance, when actually over the last 2 or even 3 years in the South, we've seen sexual violence weaponized and used as a shield for people who are bigoted and racist towards immigrants who've never cared about sexual violence before. And we're kind of using that as a way to add like valor to anti-immigration violence and protests. So I just thought that that in particular was a really strong quote. And you have the whiplash then further on in the piece, where there is an interview with a man who doesn't want to give his full name, basically saying that he wants these this violence to continue until every last Roma is out of Northern Ireland. And then the immediate whiplash of him giving another quote saying that this is nothing to do with racism.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting, because Ciara Murphy, obviously, the north of Ireland, where I'm from, like other parts of the world, has seen an increase in people who weren't born there. But you were also struck by that piece. I think it's "This Isn't the Ballymena That I Knew," and that breaks my heart.
I think I was really struck by all the coverage in the papers this morning, mostly in how shallow it was. It really didn't kind of ask what's actually going on here. What are the root causes of violent extremism? Why do people get attracted to these things? And what vulnerabilities are there in the North that actually are causing this? So it all took a very
many
face
of them
value.
are like incidences elsewhere. They're socioeconomic.
Socioeconomic, 100%. And so when you look at the literature on preventing violent extremism or on you know, social cohesion, so divisions in society, obviously in the North, that is such a huge issue. You still have sectarian schools, really limited contact as well between migrants. So actually there was an ESRI piece of research on attitudes North and South. And it basically found that the South had better attitudes, because the determinants were people feel like their voices aren't heard in politics more in Northern Ireland for very logical governance reasons, in that they don't have a government. Devolved power means that, you know, they don't actually have control over the immigration, but I assume also integration policy. So limited contact, voice not counting, and a lack of optimism about the future. So these are really socioeconomic. You know, the UK has been imposing austerity now for such a long time and creating this false sense of economic threat and scarce resources. And that is a massive contribution to all of these things. There's so much research internationally on violent extremism, and I just found that really, really lacking in the coverage of the riots.
And Graham, you know, often, you know, when these incidents flare up on the island of Ireland or elsewhere, it's usually where there are issues like problems with access to housing or to healthcare, and where people are feeling fragile, and then to point at the other or to blame it. It can be quite a tinder box, and sometimes it can just take one or two things to really ignite it.
Yeah, there's always, but with North and South, a sort of potential for recreational rioting or looting, you know, taking advantage of existing extremist violence. But there is this very alarming rise in not just violence as a form of political resistance, as they might call it, or protest, including arson, you know, in many cases, but also a willingness to endorse it, but further coordination. So I was really struck by Sam McBride's piece about
this in the Sunday Independent.
Yeah, in the Sunday Independent, on paramilitary presence in North, riots fuels racism in loyalist communities. And I realize in that context, naming that is a certain issue or something which is difficult.
And the point I think that Sam McBride was making, and it's not exclusive to Northern Ireland, but that sense of sort of coercive control of communities by paramilitaries or others, that I think he was suggesting was this doesn't happen without the knowledge or tacit consent of others.
Of paramilitaries. And we've seen increasingly North and South a greater coordination on the part of various groups. Much of it goes back to certain figures in Northern loyalism. And for years, over a decade, we've seen violence against migrants in a less sort of salient moment for immigration in both jurisdictions, largely stemming in the North from one side of the conflict. And how you deal with that, both as a state, but also as a sort of political culture, I think is very, very challenging, as Ciara said.
Cormac, you picked out Newton Emerson, his piece, "Use Broken Windows Policy for Immigration." He tries to place it in a different context.
Yeah, he's kind of putting it into a deprivation context. Mm. And if you look up the data on Ballymena, it ranks 14th out of 800 areas in Northern Ireland in terms of deprivation. But I would be worried that there's a more traditional midsummer recreational riot playing off racism with loyalist paramilitaries in some murky, undefined role in the background. And the Irish state, that's us, we have a blank check on the table saying, we want to take over Northern Ireland, please, whenever you're ready. So this problem could become our problem within 10 years. And we need to be thinking a bit more carefully about it than simply saying they need to get their act together north of the border. And I also think that the peace process, as it still is, there was a prominent loyalist paramilitary, Winky Irvine, caught with a consignment of weapons, and he got a mere 30-month prison sentence recently. The peace walls in Northern Ireland are longer than they were in 1998 when the Good Friday Agreement was concluded. And while I agree with the Taoiseach that we need to put a focus on reconciliation north of the border, I think we also need to be, we have a constitutional imperative to seek reunification. So I think I think this is another area where the government is inert and inactive in the face of a visible problem that risks getting bigger before it gets smaller, and we need to do something about it.
Yeah, Ciara, can I just bring you back to that? Because, as Cormac says, a lot of it has been linked to deprivation. Can you talk about the programmes that maybe don't work in communities where people feel neglected and unheard? And do you think that the people of Ballymena and elsewhere can find faith in the establishment? Because there's some sort of a cry coming from somewhere.
Yeah, well, I think one really interesting point is that reconciliation between Catholics and Protestants potentially just risks displacing the out-group, right? Okay, so you have to be very careful when you are talking about social cohesion that you're not just creating a new out-group. So Northern Ireland kind of has rapidly changed demographically. It's now 9% born abroad from, very, very few. And how to actually manage that integration and contact, I think, is really careful. You have to be really careful. And I think one of the things,
so many of those in the north of Ireland, as here, are healthcare workers. They are working in key and critical sectors of the economy. I want to move on, if we can, to what has been happening overnight. Graham, it was last month in Saudi Arabia that Donald Trump hailed a golden era for the Middle East. He said one that will be marked by commerce, not chaos.
Yeah, it is a very, very frightening time in the Middle East. Obviously, there's a big territorial barrier between a land war between Israel and Iran. But, the disconnect between the U.S. and the global order is really stark right now. Benjamin Netanyahu launched this attack on Iran because he could, and there are a number of interesting pieces on this today. With Iran, which is a vastly bigger country, an incredibly important country.
But incredibly much more weakened than heretofore.
So we have the spectacle of a tiny country really being the regional power in the Middle East. And with the weakening of Iran's allies and proxies in the region, with the loss of Syria as a way to transport weapons and to strike at Israel, where with Israel gaining air superiority over Syria, Netanyahu did this because he could. But the emboldening of Netanyahu and Israel to do things which they previously held back from, like assassinating leaders, striking huge strikes into civilian and nuclear targets, is profoundly destabilizing,
Cormac Lucy, obviously the US got some warning because they were able to withdraw people from embassies, and it seemed that Donald Trump kind of wanted to wait to see the outcome of the strikes before suggesting that they were very successful and the US was there. But to what extent does that risk destabilize? He's sort of caught between a rock and a hard place because, earlier this month he was saying, my plan for Iran, we want a diplomatic resolution. But the US could be drawn into that, and that would be a challenge for his supporters, particularly for MAGA or certain aspects of it, but also for the wider global economy.
Well, I think Trump could have put a stop to this had he chosen. The degree of administration foreknowledge is called into question by Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, who professed not to know, even though embassy buildings were being emptied and evacuated. If you look at this from an Israeli perspective, in my opinion, they were entitled to act against the Iranian threat. But set that to one side, they were entitled to react to the murderous attack from Gaza. The question is, having embarked and started or continued a big war, how do they credibly bring it to an end?
And that's the question.
And my fear with this Iranian thing is that they may have aggravated matters and made reaching a solution much more difficult than would have been the case 7 days ago. And there's no clear way out of this. If you're an Iranian leader, you're now going to say, we have the technology to put this together. We just need to be more effective in doing it in secret. So the impulse in Iran has been completely turned in the wrong direction.
And now they can say, like Israel, well, we're facing an existential threat.
Correct.
So you're both in that bind. Keir, what did you make of the coverage?
Yeah, I mean, I think the coverage was relatively interesting. I think really for me the interesting thing is that it's this vicious cycle idea. It's exactly what Cormac is saying. It's this idea of, you know, Israel attacks Iran and then Iran sees itself as totally legitimate and basically says the only way to protect myself is to create a deterrent and a nuclear program. And, you know, you also create this cycle of fear and hatred in the Iranian population because they're seeing their country being attacked. And then it then emboldens Israel's belief that all of its neighbors are trying to kill it and it faces a constant existential threat. And how to end that, I don't know. I think international law would be one way if everyone kind of credibly believed that everyone else was going to be respecting international law. But I think that what's happened over the last year is that Israel has gotten away with breaching international law to such a degree that it probably believes there's actually not much I can do that they will hold me accountable for. So the level of European and US support for Israel as it just consistently breaches international law to such a degree, I think has really emboldened
it. And the end game, Graham, is on the exit strategy is obviously going to be the focus of, there's a G7 summit in your hometown later on this week. As a Canadian, looking across at what's happening in the US, like obviously, you know, Donald Trump has hopes of a Nobel Peace Prize. He got elected on a ticket that he would not be drawing the US into conflicts that had beset previous presidents. So where do you think he goes from here? Has he been bounced into a situation by Israel's actions?
I mean, he's continuously bounced into a situation by Israel. In a way, it's just the blank check Israel receives from the Republican Party. The one problem for Donald Trump right now is that his party is, in fact, divided over foreign wars. He is generally being part of the isolationist camp, but there are some quite muscular anti-Iranian voices who've glommed onto the MAGA train. That is a real conflict within the party. Mm. Again, it's a lot easier for Donald Trump just to let Israel do what it wants. It's quite embarrassing that in the middle of negotiations, which were scheduled for the next few days with Iran, that Israel would launch a massive attack involving years of preparation in the days before. Donald Trump is ultimately just not that engaged with foreign affairs. And it's really striking his use of the military. He just had a massive military parade in Washington, which is the kind of military.
That has fallen down the news list,
yeah,
perhaps.
Kind of military he likes, and he likes to put military on the streets of LA, but he's very loath to put them on the streets of Baghdad, right? There are more American troops in Los Angeles than there are in Syria and Iraq right now. So he's coming to Canada. I moved here from Calgary, which is about an hour away from Kananaskis, where the summit will be held. It's incredibly fortifiable. It's just surrounded by very tall mountains, which will have snipers on them. He's going to a Canada and a meeting of international leaders who are just trying to manage him. And this was true of the previous summit in Canada. And he's going to a Canada where there will be protests. But by and large, I think Canadians, I was just there, have given up on America. But they certainly have given up on Donald Trump. And they're just going to trust the new Prime Minister, Mark Carney, to manage Trump, manage the relationship as best he can, but with always a view to Canada's interest.
Cormac Lucy, can I ask you just what the unrest will mean, you know, for us here? Look, I mean, beyond, you know, human suffering, people might be thinking, well, what about oil prices? Or has it been such a sort of a crazy ride over the last while that the markets have sort of priced that volatility in? Like, what do you think it would mean for the rest of us here and for the global economy?
Well, I think the global economy was already at the start of the year reaching a cyclical peak. And that's been threatened then by Trump's tariffs policies. And if this Iran-Israel conflict interdicts oil being transported through the Gulf, that's going to further give a shock. What's been keeping the global economy going, particularly in the United States, has been investment and the belief in the investment in artificial intelligence. It's been the roadrunner out over
interesting
the cliff.
Distinction you draw there. are you sceptical about that?
Somewhat. Yeah. But there's also the roadrunner effect where roadrunners out over the cliff, courtesy of the zero interest policy effects that were brought in to fight COVID and courtesy of Trump injecting a significant amount of state spending in the US. So what we're seeing at financial markets right now is a very interesting split where retail investors, mom and pop investors, are buying every dip. And they're reacting to bad news as an opportunity to buy cheap. Whereas the institutional hedge fund and money is tending to pull back. So we could be at a very interesting juncture in the US economy, the global economy, moving from strong growth to weaker growth, potentially to recession, which is something our own central bank governor was warning about in the Sunday Times.
In the business section. Ellen, the Israel-Iran escalation has shifted the focus internationally away from Gaza.
Yeah, it has. But I suppose even in the discussion we had there, you know, It has been written about by the in the foreign coverage today that Netanyahu was acting unilaterally. But the question is, did he act unilaterally off the back of being emboldened by such a lack of international action in terms of the bombardment of Gaza? And I think there's a really interesting profile by Matthew Campbell in the Sunday Times that kind of talks about Netanyahu as this kind of nearly like isolated figure who is obsessed with his political legacy. And it talks about how even in Israel, there was a sense growing, and it's been reflected in reports in the New York Times over the last couple of weeks, that he was extending this war on Gaza because he was afraid of losing an election. And he's so obsessed with his legacy, and how this action against Iran gives him the opportunity of creating a moment of like a national crisis and a time for people to again come together. It kind of stifles the protests against him at his anti-corruption trial.
All of this while happening whilst his own trial is underway. But listen, we are going to take a quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back. Ciara Murphy, just before the break, I detected a note of reticence on Cormac Lucy's part about the AI revolution. But you have you spotted a story which I think is quite good for a good news story for AI for elephants. At least it's in the Observer. Tusk Force.
Yeah, so this is a really lovely story about a research project in the Congo that has all these listening devices across the rainforest to listen to elephants. And its main goal is to track their movements better. And they've basically eliminated poaching because they've been able to figure out where the elephants are going to be. But also their long-term goal is to use AI to actually understand what the elephants are saying to each other. So I thought it was a really lovely, good news story about AI.
God knows what they're saying about it. Ellen, there was a piece, I thought, which was quite interesting. Pledge with an Edge. It was in the Mail on Sunday. New confirmation vow to include ban on vaping. Not a bad idea.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the piece, I didn't actually know this. Apparently the pledge has gone out of vogue. So those of us who made our confirmation will remember, you're kind of invited to vow to not drink until you're 18 and pledge to never take drugs for the rest of your life. And apparently it's been fading out and they're not even including it in confirmations anymore. But there's this move within the church as part of a kind of like anti-drugs initiative to start asking children to pledge to not smoke vapes, which is partly about kind of reviving the pledge and making it more modern and relevant. I don't know how effective it would be, but I think it's really interesting. Like, I've seen even in my own estate, the shock of seeing a plume of smoke coming out of like a 9-year-old's mouth. And I think it was the Taoiseach who said that vapes were effectively like the revenge of the tobacco industry. Like, I mean, anybody can see the way they're marketed, the colours and the flavours. They're targeted towards kids and children. It's really dystopian. Yeah. But I just thought it was a really interesting, colourful story.
I think not too many parents would object to a pledge with an edge, but I'm afraid that is all we have time for. My thanks today to Ellen Coyne, political correspondent for the Irish Times, to Ciara Murphy, senior policy officer at the ESRI, Dr. Graeme Finlay, assistant professor of politics and international relations at UCD, and Cormac Lucy, economics columnist with the Sunday Times in Ireland, just at 12 o'clock. Let's cross over to the newsroom.